This is a continuation of the interview with Barry Trost. It's now the 5th of December, 1985.
So should I just initiate?
Yes, yes.
Well, I think where we would begin in terms of talking about the research at MIT, where I was a graduate student, I had been influenced in terms of the kinds of things that could be important in science by my experiences, especially at Smith, Kline, and French, where I had spent a summer learning about medicinal chemistry. And a large aspect of the individual at Smith, Kline, and French, who really did have quite a strong influence in helping me perceive what might be important directions. So in going to MIT, I clearly was already oriented towards the question of synthesis, because in my judgment, that represented the major challenge in chemistry. Chemistry, in definition, really is the science of materials, new substances, new materials. And the question of having new materials and new substances is clearly one of how do you get there, and that's the problem of synthesis. So as I embarked upon my graduate career, this aspect of chemistry, and organic chemistry in particular, is the one that most intrigued me.
Would this be true
at the time where I had decided that synthesis was representative of the important future, the major thrust in terms of the great hype in organic chemistry was not in the area of synthesis, it was in the area of mechanisms, that is, understanding the way that chemical reactions occur. So theoretical and physical studies of reaction pathways was the in thing to do, and synthesis was not perceived to be the in thing to do. It was, however, the area that I felt represented the thing of the future. And certainly in the interim, between the time that I began my graduate studies and today, one has seen a total shift in the field, so that today synthesis represents the major thrust. At the time, of course, I didn't really realize I didn't know that that was going to happen, although I felt that this was the important area and was the reason why I got involved in the kind of research program at MIT that I did. So as I looked at the individuals doing the science there and considered the kinds of problems that they were involved in, I was trying to ask myself the question, one, let's say a more philosophical one, how important, if I succeed in solving this problem, how important will it really be? Will it influence other scientists? Will it make an important contribution? And secondly, could I do this in a reasonable period of time? Because I still, as I mentioned last time, had this burning desire to really want to get things done in a hurry rather than taking long periods of time. So I had a more philosophical mission or criterion, and I also had a practical criterion in choosing what kind of research program. And
you went up to MIT with this philosophical question in your mind.
I think that as I approached my career at MIT as a graduate student, I did have in mind the idea that I would like to try to accomplish something that would have a lasting impact on the field. It doesn't mean that one feels that you have a high chance of being successful in doing that, but I think it's a goal that you'd like to feel that there is something more to it that you've accomplished than just your own self-satisfaction, that there would be something beyond your own self-satisfaction in the accomplishments that you make. And that certainly was in my mind as I embarked on my career there, and is in my mind today. While doing things which I feel are fun to do and enjoyable to do is a very important part of it, it still has the underlying goal that I would feel even more satisfied if I felt that it was making a contribution that was affecting the way that people practiced the science, that it was having a real impact. And not that, well, that's very nice, but if we never knew about it, we haven't lost anything. That the fact that, yeah, that's nice, and indeed, by knowing that, we have now been able to accomplish something quite different. It's the latter case that I would like to feel that we are in our own research, and then not the former, and is the way that I certainly began my program at MIT. I was very fortunate in the sense that the program I got involved in retrospect, I think, can be said to have really met those goals. The research was with a younger member of the faculty there. It wasn't with one of the illustrious stars of the day. He used to use the terms, these kinds of studies represent the meat and potatoes of the science of synthetic chemistry. And I think that's a pretty good description of what it is he was trying to accomplish. It wasn't the elegant, cute, novel, esoteric thing, but it was really the fundamental thing, the things that keep the science alive, that he was trying to address. And by being able to do that in a fashion that was practical, it did have a major impact, and it has now been considered classical, even though it's only, well, right now it would be 20 years old. This, in today's world of science, things move at such a rapid rate, something that's 20 years old now is considered classical work.
Okay. What is 20 years old?
The work that I did as a graduate student with him, and the work that other graduate students did in his laboratories, these really have set the stage for what is now a very important general synthetic strategy for making organic molecules that is used worldwide.
So he was really a significant person. I didn't get that impression exactly from what you said last time.
Well, Well, there are two aspects to that. One is that there were two groups who were working more or less simultaneously in the same area. And the community at large generally ascribes the major development that I am referring to more towards the other group than to him. Mm. And in that respect, I think he's not getting quite as much recognition for the depth of his contribution. I feel, probably because of my own personal relationships with him and my own experiences, that his work has not been as much recognized as being the underlying basis for this chemistry. This is called enolate chemistry. For this enolate chemistry as that of this other group. But it was contemporary with it, and in some cases it's complementary in the sense that they both looked at things from a somewhat slightly different perspective, coming and contributing to the development of this field. But the field that evolved was, or is, today, the single most important reaction. Of all the hundreds of reactions that exist, this is probably the single most important reaction if you just look at how many times it's used in carrying out synthesis.
And they were discovering this at the time?
They established an understanding of this reaction and in a way of controlling this reaction to a level that never existed before. And by being able to exercise a new dimension of control, this now increased tremendously the number of applications of the reaction. So it wasn't that they discovered this de novo. What they did was understand more or less an existing phenomenon, and by understanding it, find a way of controlling it. And by being able to that, now that just opened up a tremendous horizon as to directions that you could apply it in, which didn't exist before. And that's really what his work did. And there are two of the two individuals, my former major professor in
whose house,
and Gilbert Stork, and I think I mentioned
is
his
name. Is that
S-T-O-R-K? As I've mentioned, Stork is a former graduate of this department, actually. These two individuals.
Oh, see, the Columbian man.
Right.
I see this man at MIT, and okay.
Then the man at Columbia. These two are the individuals who were working contemporaneously in this program. And Stork, who is a brilliant figure, there's no question about that. I have a tremendous admiration for this, for him. But people generally ascribe to him solely the development rather than giving really joint credit. And I think joint credit is the most appropriate one for that area. When I came to Madison, it was fairly clear in my mind as to the general directions of the kind of research that I would get involved in. One thing that I have a strong feeling about is that as an independent scientist, it is important that one be independent. That means that one does not involve yourself into an area of research that is a direct extrapolation from the PhD thesis. This is not always the case in terms of science, and in many instances one gets the feeling that the research that's being done is a repeat of the PhD thesis but with a higher level of sophistication. That is not the situation that I felt was the appropriate way of proceeding, that in initiating my own program that it was important it not be related in any direct way to what I did as a graduate student.
Because that was part of House's work.
Right. And I wanted to have an independent recognition for anything that I achieved and not simply say, well, all he's doing is what House has done and you can't really tell them apart.
When did you decide that?
Oh, I decided that very early in, essentially, when I decided that I was going to go into academics, it was sort of, I took it as, I didn't have to make it as a conscious decision because it was always essentially just there that it was important for me to have my own identity.
I mean, is this something graduate students talk about, or where'd you get the idea?
Well, it is something that graduate students talk about. It is something that I talk about with my graduate students and postdoctoral students, because I think it is so important. I do believe that a scientist should, say, one, try to address things that are important for the science at large, that provide a level of excitement and interest for themselves so that they can have a high level of motivation, and also provide a way for having it identified with themselves, that if this is an accomplishment that one knows immediately that that is accomplishment of such an individual. Mm-hmm. In chemistry, organic chemistry in particular, there is a tradition to have what is called name reactions. What that means, what it is in one sense is a mnemonic in which it allows you to associate with a particular chemical transformation an individual's name so that you can say in that one word an awful lot. Uh-huh. So you said you carry out this reaction by the Diels-Alder reaction. Well, everybody knows what the Diels-Alder reaction is, and as soon as you say those words, you don't have to say anything else. But of course, there's the counter argument, the counter aspect of that, and that is that by saying the Diels-Alder reaction, obviously, you are also identifying a particular transformation with the accomplishments of those individuals. In that case, it's two people, Diels and Alder. This is the kind of thing that I think a scientist should try to ascribe to in terms of saying that this development in the science was a development of that individual, and he therefore had this kind of impact on the science. It's a way of, to say directly, recognizing that the person really did have an impact on the science and the practice of the science, essentially for all time. I think in anything that you do, in any activity, one is trying to do one's best, and this then becomes a goal that not too many people achieve. But I think a goal should always be at least something that you think you could reach, but a little beyond. And in that respect, that's the way I've approached my own independent career. And so I said, when I'm going to come to Madison, or when I go into my academic career, because I didn't know I was going to come to Madison at the time, of course, that it should be something that would be divorced from anything else that I had been associated with. And in this case, it would have meant enolate chemistry. It doesn't mean synthetic chemistry, because that is clearly, as a field, that's a tremendously broad field. And it doesn't mean I can't do synthetic chemistry, but I shouldn't do enolate chemistry, because this is what I did as a graduate student. And I should get myself involved in some aspects of synthetic chemistry, which would be quite different from enolate chemistry. And that's what I did when I came here. Now, synthetic chemistry is, as I mentioned, a very broad field. It can range anywhere from electronics, because new electronic materials are substances, compounds, materials that are synthesized. And in fact, we had some interest along those lines in our early stages of my program here. So making materials of interests that may have properties that might be of interest for some particular applications, like electronics, might represent an outlet. Natural products chemistry, compounds that have biological activity, had been a mainstay of organic chemistry. That's where it has its foundings. The understanding of the molecules of nature represents the beginnings of organic chemistry. And the science has gone through ups and downs in terms of the level of interest in natural products, biologically active substances. At the time in which I was a graduate student, it sort of was at a low point in this cyclical series of events, whereas today it's at an elevated point. Now, whether it's at the high point or still rising, we can't tell right now. I think it's still rising. But that has always been closely tied to synthesis per se, because synthesis in many events provide the bridge for understanding the molecules of nature and making these available and making modifications that could be important, for example, as new pharmaceutical agents. So that was another direction of synthetic chemistry that I thought could be interesting, and in part would have also derived from the experience I had at Smith, Kline, and French laboratories, where obviously they're in the business of making pharmaceuticals. And then the third aspect would be what one would call methods. That is the chemical reactions that you practice to make a material. You mix together reagents and they undergo a reaction and they make something new. Mm-hmm. Well, these reactions are also things that one can invent. And the invention of reactions represents what I would say is the third leg of what I felt would be the important problems for synthetic chemistry. And so as I got myself involved in an independent program, these were the directions that I was looking for. The work I did as a graduate student would fall into this last category. Mm-hmm. Not so much from the point of view of really inventing a new reaction, because that's not what was done, but from the point of view of finding a way of controlling an existing reaction to make it more useful. Okay, so that's what was done there. And what I had looked forward to in terms of my own career would be also staying in that general area of reactions, but away from the enolate chemistry. And I think the experience I had at MIT was a very self-satisfying one, in that it really did reach my goals and gave me, say, an initial start, which was with a great deal of momentum, because it did, at the time that the work was published, which was again very soon after the work was finished, my PhD thesis was finished, and that was one thing that I appreciated an awful lot from my major professor at MIT House, that he didn't wait for long periods of time to publish things, that in the scientific world, publishing and getting things in front of the community is very important to the career of the individuals. And I very much appreciated that on his part. And it indeed had a big effect in giving me a start in my academic career, which was very important.
This is tape 3, interview with Barry Trost. Was there competition in what you were doing when you were in graduate school? I mean, was it important to get it published, to get it out ahead of somebody?
Well, as it turned out, the answer to that was yes, because while we were not fully knowledgeable of the work that was going on at Columbia in Stark's group, it obviously was being done quite contemporaneously with the work that we were doing at MIT. And if we did not have our work published at the time we did, it probably would have been very much to our detriment. Competition in science, I think, is generally a healthy thing, like in probably almost any aspects of life. It does provide some of the individual motivation that seems to be so important in almost any human endeavor. Competing with someone else and trying to do, say, reach the solution sooner and better is the kinds of things that probably drive almost any subgroup of society, and certainly scientists are not immune from that as a driving force for doing good science. So yes, it did exist. We didn't realize how close it existed at the time. I mean, obviously we were aware of the general areas that were going on there, but we were not knowledgeable about how closely related they might have been to the work that we were doing. That, I think, is always an aspect of the science that one does keep in the back of your mind. Today, too, I feel a great deal of urgency that the work be done and published, not published prematurely. I think that's a danger that can lead to a lot of mistakes in science. And I think scientists have an obligation to make sure that what they're publishing is correct, and they don't jump to a erroneous conclusion just to get something printed before they really have a right to get it printed. But on the other hand, it is important that it does get printed in a timely fashion. It shouldn't be years later. It should be done in a fashion that when the work has reached a satisfactory level of completion, that it should be written up, that it's important for the science and it's important for the students and their careers. And that's a philosophy that I have tried very hard to practice all the way through. As I said, I saw this in my own major professor, and I think that's one of also the take-home lessons that I took home from him, was that this was an important part for me to do. When I came to Madison, you are sometimes not all that sophisticated or mature in your scientific judgments. And in my own case, because I was somewhat in a hurry and because I didn't go through the more normal sequence of going, say, first of all, I was only in graduate school 2.5 years rather than 4 years, and now these days it's more like 5 years. And I didn't go into a postdoctoral stay, which these days is around 2 years, that I went directly from my graduate studies into my career. That you don't necessarily have the same maturity of judgment in terms of the research programs that you might have otherwise gotten involved in. And that sometimes can be very detrimental. I've seen some awfully, awfully bright scientists who didn't succeed, I'd say mainly because they didn't have that scientific maturity in deciding what are important problems, what are interesting questions to ask. And because they didn't have that maturity, the time went by that they didn't really have the accomplishments, and so they didn't make it in the academic world.
Do you discuss it? When you're starting a program, discuss it with anybody? For instance, your major professor at MIT?
Well, in my own case, I didn't.
Did you discuss it with anybody?
No, I didn't, actually. No. It just was things that interested me. And probably I was lucky in part that some of those things turned out to be pretty important. So it worked out all right. But also there was some happenstance in coming to Madison, which we'll get into in just a few minutes, as to what are the things that say affect a research program. How do you go in one direction or another? And the juvenile hormone story is certainly one where it was a totally unplanned event as far as my own program was concerned. It was a happenstance of circumstances which came about because I happened to come to Madison. And if I had gone somewhere else, the same thing wouldn't have happened. So there was a situation that arise, a very exciting situation, and it arose because I did come to Madison. Madison was the place, and nowhere else would that have happened to me. So there always is that aspect to the science as well. If one looks at a student emerging from being dependent to becoming independent, that transition period can always be a rather difficult one. Some people make it better than others. I fortunately fell into the category of being able to make that transition rather well, even though I didn't have a lot of the additional experiences that, say, virtually all of my colleagues or all of my contemporaries had. My major contemporaries did have the benefits of, say, a longer incubation period to develop their scientific maturity and judgments and before they began their careers. I didn't, but it didn't hurt.
This is interesting. I assume you're going to develop what you're saying, so I'm not asking questions yet. But
well, as I mentioned,
You seem to be saying that you were very young when you started, and you might have gone in completely wrong direction easily and
very
didn't.
Easily. Well, that's right. There were a lot of events that occurred that were not things that one would have a priori planned ahead. My coming to Madison, in part, was also a situation that was somewhat akin to what we were discussing the other day in terms of choosing graduate schools, although not quite the same thing. When I decided that I wanted to go into academics, and then we started to look around to see various places.
You did make that decision. You mean you might have gone into industry, but
yes, in chemistry, industry is not only a viable option, but the vast majority of graduate students who finish PhD degrees end up in industry rather than in academics. So it is a science where the PhD degree is as important for industry as it is for academics.
So why?
Certainly 90% of the PhDs in chemistry go to industry.
Mm-hmm. So why did you decide to go into academics? And when?
My motivation for going into academics was really the motivation to be able to decide by myself what it is that I would do, rather than having someone else telling me what should be the directions that I should be interested in. Mm-hmm. That industry does not offer the opportunity for an individual to really express themselves totally. That academics provides that type of environment.
Does that mean you usually get more original people in the academic world?
Well, that's hard to say. I would have to say that the answer to that is probably not necessarily so, that you get more original people. But I think it would be true that if you look at the group of academicians, that a larger fraction of the academicians would...
Is she... go on.
If... it's like a person who chooses to go into a job working for some company, or whether you want to decide you want to start your own company.
Yeah, I don't think it's a good question, so I just drop it. I mean, I can imagine that you'd get both the various reasons people would do either one.
Yeah.
So go on.
If we look at in terms of academics, I can't say as to when I made a conscious decision that I would want to go into academics versus industry. From the very first time I started graduate school, I sort of assumed that I was going to go into academics rather than industry. And I don't remember anywhere along the line really sitting down and saying that I have to make this decision, and then at some point in time saying, well, I've decided that this is the direction I wanted to go. It really was always in the back, it was always just there that that's what I was going to do. That I never considered industry as an option. And when it came that I was going to be approaching the end of my, or say, looking ahead, we say, well, I'm going to be able to finish my degree in such and such a time, we have to start looking, you know. Then it was immediate, as far as I was concerned, that, yeah, I'd like to see what are the academic jobs available. And here's a where House, you know, he came to me and we talked about this. And at MIT, the faculty there had the habit of discussing their students more or less just as a group rather than just as each individual professor. And they, as a group, strongly supported me in terms of various possible applications. And there were a number of opportunities that we talked about. There was a junior faculty position at Yale and at Harvard and at Wisconsin and a couple of other places. I just fundamentally ruled out Harvard right off the bat just because it was a tradition in the chemistry department at Harvard that junior faculty just don't get tenure. No matter what they accomplish, and they've certainly shown that, because several people who did not get tenure at Harvard have gone on to win Nobel Prizes, for example. One person that I admired an awful lot, Gilbert Stork, the man that we were talking about before, he had also been a junior faculty person at Harvard and didn't get tenure there. And as I mentioned, if you look at his career, he certainly is one of the most illustrious scientists of the day, so that just didn't appear to be something that I would want to do. I would like to go to a place where, if I was able to accomplish what I thought I would be able to accomplish, that I'd be appreciated and be able to have a permanent position on the faculty. And Yale did not attract me very much, mainly because it was not a very good department per se in science. At that stage in Yale's history, it was quite renowned for its strength in humanities and professional schools, but the sciences were not a strong suit for Yale, and that, as a result, was not attractive. Wisconsin was not attractive because, having grown up on the East Coast, I really had never come this far. It just seemed to be so far away. As I mentioned, I had applied to Wisconsin as a graduate student because it was an excellent program, but the application in retrospect was not a serious one because there was just no way that I was really going to come out here. So I found myself in the situation then of having to make that decision again, but now at a different level in terms of coming here as a faculty person. And at that point in time, because I had made at least one big move in my life, going from my home city to Boston, the idea of coming to somewhere else was not as traumatic experience. And as I said, Wisconsin had an incredibly good reputation, and so I decided to interview here. And I think it was only a few days after I interviewed here where one of the people in the faculty called me up and said that they were going to be making me an offer and they would hope very much that I would come. And before I knew it, they made me an offer and I decided to accept it and came out to Wisconsin. So it was a situation where I really didn't, say, interview at 10 places and then make a decision. We only talked about a few places, and most of them I could rule out pretty definitely for various reasons. And so it really came down to being, Wisconsin was the first place I interviewed, and because they made me an offer, and it looked like it would be a good place to start a career, I really didn't even think about going ahead and interviewing other places. And the people at MIT also encouraged me to come here because of the strength of the program. And in retrospect, it was a very good decision.
Somebody else came from MIT that year, too.
Yes. Here in the department?
I thought so.
Steve Nelson came from Harvard that same year that I came. But we have several people in the faculty here from MIT who came in subsequent years. So Chuck Casey, for example, is an MIT graduate who joined us a few years later. Marion O'Leary is an MIT graduate who joined us some years later. Let's see, who else?
Well, it doesn't matter.
Yeah, we have a number of people here from MIT, but I was the only one in chemistry who came from MIT that year.
Well, what did attract you here?
Well, I think the main thing that attracted me to Madison really was the reputation of this as a place for having a very, very high quality program, which means three things. One, the colleagues that are scientifically stimulating. Two, a level of graduate students that would be rather high. And three, a resource space, facilities, equipment, etc., which would be very good. So it's really those qualities that made Madison a very attractive place.
Did you have special requests in the way of space or equipment?
No, I didn't. That was a big difference between today and then. In 1965, which is when this was happening, there still were relatively few academic jobs available, certainly at the top places. And the numbers of students looking for academic jobs was, say, rather large compared to the available positions. So it was very much a buyer's market, if you want. When I came to Madison, they didn't even have an office for me. I had to share an office with an emeritus professor. It turned out that the emeritus professor really had essentially removed himself from the department. So sharing an office simply meant that his name was also on the door with mine, but he was never there. And in fact, he spent most of his time in Hawaii at the time. So I had an office and I had a laboratory, and I think the grand sum of maybe like $2,500 for startup funds was what I began with. Whereas today, when we talk about starting an assistant professor, you have to have a reasonable amount of space to be able to accommodate him and what you would anticipate to be a rapidly growing group. You would be also talking about startup funds, frequently in excess of $100,000. So it's quite a different situation just in a short period of time. Part of the differences comes about in the developments in the science itself. In 65, we were still at a stage, especially from the point of view of synthetic chemistry, that a large fraction of a person's needs were what we classify as expendable supplies. These would be the flasks, the glassware, the chemicals that one uses. That if you have a normally equipped laboratory, it's really the glassware and chemicals that you need in order to get started. Between that time and today, like almost any aspect of our life, we have been very much influenced by the developments that have occurred in instrumentation. And instrumentation in chemistry has, say, grown at exponential rates over this period of time.
I'm surprised that it had started earlier. It seems to have in the other branches, the 40s and 50s.
Well, it got started in the 40s and 50s. That's correct. But it still was not the level of impact as it is today. So that in the 1940s came the first recording spectrometers that synthetic chemists found important. So infrared spectroscopy was developed in the 1940s as a practical tool for the practicing synthetic chemist. But as a new faculty member, it was anticipated that this would be something that would be available as a general use instrument and not something that we had to have ourselves. Mm-hmm. Whereas today, it's something that we have to have ourselves, and we have one sitting down here. NMR spectroscopy, which is having such a tremendous impact, even beyond chemistry, had its start, as a chemical research tool in the 1950s, late 50s. And that was considered big instruments at the time. But again, it was a type of tool that was mainly employed as a departmental resource rather than something that an individual research group would necessarily have. So it was something that the department had as a resource, and I, as a member of the staff, would have access to. But it's not something that one would necessarily say that you have to have such an instrument in your own laboratories. Mm-hmm. So there was clearly the beginnings of instrumentation that were very importantly affecting the practice of the science. But the way that you went about making compounds was still more or less the classical one, whereas that isn't true today. When you're understanding reactions or having analytical methods to be able to see what is happening during reactions has become an increasingly important aspect of the practice of the science. So whereas NMR spectroscopy was a tool that you used after you did a lot of other work, and then you got a really pure compound, and then did you get an NMR spectrum. Today, you are in fact examining a reaction as it is going on using NMR spectroscopy. So it is an integral part of the actual practice of the reaction. Whereas earlier, you did the reaction, you worked up reactions, you isolated pure substances, and only after you did all of that would you take an NMR spectrum. Today, you start off with running a reaction and taking an NMR spectrum during the course of it. So it's a total turnaround. There is an emphasis on the idea of understanding as you are doing, to analyze as things are happening. And the tools to be able to do that have been and are being developed. And it's that aspect that has made the science much more instrumental oriented and has made the costs of doing the science that much more expensive. It has also made it possible to do things that you would never have been able to do before, because now, whereas before you ran a reaction and it was sort of arbitrary. Should you run this for 1 hour, 1 day, 1 week? You really never knew. So you just choose some arbitrary period of time. Should you run this at very low temperatures, very high temperatures, at room temperature? Again, it was all guesswork, intuition. But if you can have a way to be able to look into the reaction flask as things are happening, you can begin answering these kinds of questions in a much more direct way, so it isn't just happenstance. But by being able to do that, you don't miss things. Because if you run things at room temperature for 5 hours, you could go through five reactions during that period of time and never know it. Well, today you have a good chance of being able to detect all the things that might be happening. That's the difference. And that means that we can now do things which we could never do before. We can make materials we couldn't make before, because they were formed in the first 5 minutes and then were destroyed in the next 4 hours. Okay, now we can at least find out, hey, that's really being formed there. Now we can go after it.
So you've used the same term for the equipment, NMR spectroscopy.
That's one type of equipment.
Are you saying that it has changed enough so that you can do things differently, or that nobody thought at the time of doing what, in fact, you could have done then if anybody thought of it, which was looking on during the process?
Both. Both are true. One is that it was a sufficiently new technique, and at that time considered to be a very expensive tool, that people felt that you used it only when you really had to use it. And that was at a very late stage.
Like a computer.
Like early days of computers, when you had these humongously big instruments, big computers, and they were very, very expensive, that you used an old-fashioned atom machine rather than starting to do calculations on a computer, right? Mm. Well, today, you don't even use the adding machine has disappeared, right? So we all use a computer. Typewriters are now disappearing, and everybody's using word processors. Well, the NMR spectrometer in 1965 was still considered to be like the big initial computers that came along, and only for problems that couldn't be solved in any other way that you use the NMR. Today, we don't think about it that way anymore. Now, there were a few people who were trying to use NMR even at that time to understand reactions. People like Jack Roberts at Caltech, who was early involved in NMR spectroscopy as a tool for trying to understand reaction mechanisms. But it was just very, very few groups that would be involved in trying to use NMR in that way, and that was their main research thrust. That was their major research, and a synthetic chemist would never think about using NMR to follow reactions. So it was that aspect. But there was also another aspect, and that is that the developments in NMR that have occurred have made it, one, possible to take spectra in much shorter periods of time. So instead of having to take an hour in order to measure a spectrum, you can measure a spectrum in a matter of, literally 30 seconds today. And it may take 5 minutes to plot out everything and get all the information, but the actual taking of a spectrum occurs very fast, whereas in 1965, it would take you at least 30 minutes in order to get a decent spectrum. Today, our sensitivity by this technique is incredibly better because of developments that have come along, new ways to carry out the NMR experiment. We can now take micrograms, that's 10 to the minus 6 grams of material, and actually be able to measure spectra, whereas in 1965 we were talking about, say, tens of milligrams as being small samples. 100 milligrams was an ideal sample. Well, that's five powers of 10 more sample. So the size of the sample is tremendously different. That opens up again the prospects of being able to use it for applications today, which we could never do before. So it's really a combination of both. But NMR is only one technique.
Yeah.
But it is probably the single most important one. But if I go through my labs and I now see the kinds of equipment that we have to have to do research, it starts with computers, because we have to have computers today to do chemistry, even synthetic chemistry, to help us conceptualize. In 1965, that was unheard of. And we have analytical tools, infrareds, chromatographic equipment, cryoscopic equipment, inert atmosphere equipment, high pressure equipment, all of this in order to practice the science. Virtually none of that was considered necessary in 65. They would have considered to be relatively esoteric, whereas today it's really an integral part of the science. So there has been some big changes as to what you need to do it to do synthetic chemistry. And as you look ahead to the future, one feels that it's going to get even more esoteric rather than less.
How did what was available here in Wisconsin compare to what you had to work with at MIT in terms of equipment?
Very good. Wisconsin is particularly well noted for having just first-rate resources. And I would say that that reputation, which existed in 1965, still exists today. Mm-hmm. We were very fortunate, I must say, that in that period in Wisconsin's history, there was a member of the faculty, Professor Paul Bender, who had a great appreciation for the revolution that was going to happen in chemistry in terms of instrumentation. He had his background in, he's a physical chemist, but he had his background more or less in spectroscopy. And he was able to see from that background in spectroscopy that this area was going to be a much more general tool for the practice of chemistry, and was very influential in the department in establishing what we now recognize as our instrumentation center. And I would say that Paul really established what has become almost a prototype for what has been created at many other universities in the country subsequently. What he did was two very important things, which were really not done before. First, to point out that there would be necessary on a department-wide basis the acquisition and running of research resources in instrumentation. It had normally been the practice that instruments were bought by individual research groups as they needed them. It wasn't a notion that it was a shared resource mm-hmm. that could be of benefit to a broad spectrum of the faculty of a department, but that each individual member in the department more or less bought whatever equipment they needed for their research. This idea that one should have a departmental facility, that people could be users of the equipment, they didn't have to be experts in NMR, for example, or experts in mass spectroscopy, but there should be a resource available that non-experts could come to and say, I want to be able to treat this as a black box, but get the information that it can give me. He helped establish that here. And this certainly has to be one of the very first places that that was done, if not the first. So that's the first. That was one of the first things that he did that I think was very important. The other thing that he did, which was very important, is to help inform people on the faculty who were not, who did not know much about these developments and about what one might be able to do with this kind of facility, with these kinds of instruments. To inform them, telling them that you really should be interested in this development because this development can do A, B, C, and D. And these are the kinds of things that you're trying to accomplish. And that this can really benefit your research an awful lot. So he also provided an information source to help you realize what might be new directions that you might be able to, or new opportunities that you might be able to use to help solve the kinds of problems that you were interested in.
Yeah, I would imagine that was rather rare.
That was very rare.
In a university.
Right. That he would say that, hey, there's this development coming along. This can really do some things. We should, even though nobody here said this is something important we should have, he would say this is something important that we should have because once it's here, you will find that you'll be able to solve problems, answer questions that you couldn't do before, and get it here. And then once having it here, people could start using it and learning and finding out that it, in fact, everything he said was true. And that started, again, a tradition that we've maintained today.
This is a side question, but did people come from other departments to use your equipment? Biochemistry, for instance, or didn't they need to?
Well,
maybe you don't know.
Well, yeah, I do know.
Is this something to go into later? Because later I am going to be asking you in connect.
Yeah, well, maybe we should postpone that to later because one of Paul's great strengths was his ability of seeing these things. One of his well, I wouldn't say weaknesses, but maybe one of his blind spots was that he was very chauvinistic towards the department, and he looked out very much for the interests of the department and the faculty in the department, and was not so cooperative with people outside the department. Mm. And that did cause some problems, but the kinds of facilities that he was establishing clearly had implications beyond the chemistry department. Mm. Absolutely. But they were not necessarily always practiced smoothly because of Paul's outlooks on things, which served this department very well in many ways. And maybe at the time it was really the right thing to do, because it was still, these were relatively early. The instruments weren't so easy to really use, and perhaps they would not have worked as well if they were open on a much broader basis than he had. He kept a pretty tight rein on the operation, and I think that probably was necessary at the time. Mm. So these kinds of things were certainly already in place here in Madison, and that is something that I, as a say, beginning faculty person, could see would offer an opportunity. There were other things that made Madison attractive. Things like the existence of Wharf was important. The idea that the university had a resource base through the graduate school to Wharf that provided some support did play a big role. They, for example, at that time provided guaranteed summer salary support. In fact, they were able to let me come early. Instead of coming in September, I came in June because, as I mentioned before, I had finished my thesis work after 2.5 years, and I was just more or less spending a few months at MIT, sort of just doing research of my own, because a position really wasn't available here yet. Okay, I mean, I was hired for the following fall, even though I could have come probably in January. So I spent until June, more or less just doing research on my own at MIT. House was very kind in saying, well, look, why don't you just get some things started that you think you might be interested in right here, and let me more or less go off on my own, which really was very nice.
You couldn't go abroad.
I could go abroad, but it wouldn't have done me, for a matter of about 4 or 5 months, it wouldn't have been worthwhile to do that. Essentially being already set up at MIT, it was just much more fruitful to be able to just do it there. I was familiar with the department, I was familiar with where things were and how to get research done, and it really was very easy for me to just stay there and actually get some things accomplished. But I was able to get started here in June, and that was made possible by Wharf. So Wharf played a big role, I would say, in having me decide to come to Madison. It has been a good place. It is a good place.
So you came here, you had an office and a lab.
We had an office and a lab.
And you knew what you were going to do.
We had I had some research programs that I wanted to get involved in, which I started some on my own over the summer period. Madison was a place at that time which had large numbers of good students coming in as graduate students, and in my very, shortly after the beginning of the semester, I had 3 graduate students join my group. Joining a non-existent group, or started my group, I should say. And so we had a program going just a few months after coming here. And one of the projects, as I mentioned at that time, the real emphasis in chemistry was really towards theoretical chemistry and mechanistic chemistry. But I was interested in synthetic chemistry. So I sort of combined my interest in synthetic chemistry with things that were sort of in vogue at the time in terms of these theoretical areas. and got involved in what one would say was related to developing organic materials for electrical conduction. There are many applications where organic conductors could be very useful, and it was in that direction that I began some of my work. So one of my first graduate students worked on in this area, as I did when I had started out here. This turned out to be, in fact, my research proposition at MIT. As part of the PhD program, we have here, and it's more or less been a traditional type of thing, to have the students propose an area of research which they think would be interesting, and to defend this area of research before a faculty committee. This has to be something that is divorced from what you're doing for your PhD thesis or work that is related to things going on in this department or at that time at MIT. And so I had proposed the synthesis of a molecule which I felt would have, from a theoretical point of view, properties, rather unusual electronic properties, that might be of interest in developing organic metals. Now, there are a lot of reasons why you'd like to have organic metals. They wouldn't corrode, they would be lightweight rather than heavyweight, and they could have a lot of very desirable properties to replace more traditional metals. So I had proposed this at MIT, and it's one of the first projects that I worked on actually here, and one of my first students worked in this area. Another area that we were working in, this would really fall into the class of really the synthesis of new materials. The second area was developing new reactions, and so we began studying a class of reactions that I had some familiarization with, but it had been almost very, very little work had been done in. So we had had with one of my other graduate students, and some work that I also was doing was related to that aspect of the program, developing the reactions. And the third student was also involved in making a molecule that would have rather unusual properties. So two were involved in syntheses of unusual, theoretically interesting molecules, and one in methodology. And I sort of was spreading myself among all the areas. During that time, we have across the street the Department of Zoology, and Herbert Roller was working in the Department of Zoology. And he is an entomologist by training and not a chemist. And in many areas of biology, zoology being one subclass of biology, people are becoming much more molecular in nature in trying to understand the biological phenomena. In his case, he was trying to understand the phenomenon in which insects go from the egg to the adult. Mm-hmm. And what is the biochemical mechanisms that control that maturation process. Quite a timely subject in entomology at that time. And many of the leading entomologists were involved in this. And he was trying to isolate what had become known in the trade as juvenile hormone. But recognizing that they didn't have resources over there to really do some of the chemistry, especially in trying to understand, to determine structure, they actually talked with Paul Bender, because many of the tools that one was dealing with in our instrumentation center were tools to understand structure. And Bender suggested to them that they talk to me, being one, a new member on the faculty here, that and two, being interested in synthesis and related areas, that maybe some collaboration with me would be helpful in helping to solve this problem of the isolation and structure determination of the juvenile hormone. And that's how we got involved in juvenile hormone chemistry. It's just that they had come over to see Bender about how could they go about trying to determine the structure using these instruments, and he really suggesting that, you really should get a chemist, one of the people here involved in that. And since I was Well, also, I was involved in the Instrumentation Center as being one of the few members of faculty in the area of organic chemistry who personally could operate all these instruments downstairs. Because having come here as a beginning faculty person, not having any group, if I'm going to get use of those facilities, I didn't have any students to train on those facilities, so I had to do it myself. So I was able to operate all of the NMR spectrometers that we had, and we had, at the time, the most sophisticated NMR spectrometers that were available. And the one that we really needed was an HA100 spectrometer, and I was one of the few people in the department who actually knew how to use it. And same thing with mass spectroscopy. I ran all of my own samples, and in fact, I ran all the samples from my group at that time. Again, it was because I had that familiarization with the instrumentation downstairs, plus my overall knowledge in chemistry, that he had suggested that they come to me, and in fact, were able to isolate a very, very small sample of the juvenile hormone, about 150 micrograms. And nobody had ever taken an NMR spectrum on 150 micrograms. As I mentioned, at that time, 100 milligrams was the norm. So here we're taking 4 powers of 10 less. That was quite a
So this is
challenge.
After you talked to him. You remember when he came to you and asked you? What was it like? How did you feel about it?
I was very excited about the prospects of trying to get involved in collaborative arrangements with scientists in other areas. And it seemed to me like, as I mentioned, having an interest in synthesis, and synthesis always had a strong tie to the question of molecules of biological significance, that this seemed to me to be perhaps a very exciting direction where we could get ourselves involved in the program from essentially the beginning, that we wouldn't be taking materials that other people have identified, that here we could get involved in the process of actually identifying the compounds themselves and then getting involved in the synthesis of these compounds.
Presumably you could have done this with any one of hundreds or thousands of compounds. I mean, it's strictly random that it happens to be a juvenile hormone. I'm just guessing.
No, I mean, in this particular case, yes, it's random in the sense that one could establish collaborations with quite a few different
individuals. I mean, they might have been working on, I don't know, let's say an aging hormone or...
Right. Yeah. So it's random in the case that, sure, one could have gotten involved with some other groups which were interested in different types of materials. And in this case, it's not something that I went out and sought. It really was somebody coming to me and saying, well, look, there is this problem. Would you be interested in getting involved? And they, of course, had this as their major, in fact, their only thrust in their research. It was all around the isolation of this compound.
They were just interested in isolating it. Is that right?
They were interested in isolating it, but they wanted to do more than isolate it. They wanted to isolate it to really show that that there was a chemical entity that one could identify as a juvenile hormone, that there was a pure substance that had all of the biological activity that had been attributed to such a compound, two, that one could identify in detail what the structure of this compound would be. Because by understanding the structure, that then would unlock the key to trying to see whether we could use this kind of mechanism to help develop new generations of pesticides.
Yeah. So they were going all the way to the end in what they had in mind.
Well, I don't think that they really felt the need that they really wanted to go to generating new classes of pesticides, but they wanted to go to the stage of fully defining the juvenile hormone, including the structure, but realized that they didn't have the expertise to do the latter. But by once having done that, then that would provide the basis for mainly, hopefully, scientists and industry, where they are better equipped to take discoveries of this kind and try to say, okay, we now know this about the juvenile hormone. Let's use that as the jumping off point to design
practical new pesticides. Yeah.
And did you have that? Did you think of that when you talked to them? I mean, was this in your mind as an application of it?
Oh yes. When it wasn't in my mind in advance, but it was in my mind as we talked about it and as they were discussing why this was an important problem.
Yeah.
It becomes rather obvious that what some of the potential aspects of this problem.
But before that, couldn't have cared less about juvenile hormones.
No, that's right.
Yeah.
Right. My exposure to juvenile hormone really occurred totally in this happenstance fashion, where they came over and through Paul Bender came to see me. So it really, it was not by design in any way. I didn't seek them out to say, hey, I know you're working on juvenile hormone. I think it could be an interesting problem, because I never heard of juvenile hormone at that time. I learned a lot. In fact, I still have, from the days there, some pictures of monarch butterflies over there on my bulletin board, which comes from those days of juvenile hormone care.
You didn't have to go out and hunt butterflies, I don't suppose.
No, they do their own rearing.
What were they like? I hadn't heard of either of them. Were they young?
They're no longer here. Well, Herbert Roller, the team there was Herbert Roller and Carl Dahm. They both came from Germany.
Oh.
They were younger faculty. Herbert at that time probably was around 40.
See, you were 24 then.
I was 24 at that time, right? Mm-hmm. So Herbert was around 40, mm-hmm. and he already was a full professor of zoology here, and had a reputation of being an exceedingly precise, exceedingly careful experimentalist. And that's what it really took in this area, mm-hmm. in order to actually solve the problem. So I think it's really Herbert's and Carl Dahm's skills that made that problem a success. That their care in really isolating pure compounds, because these compounds are so incredibly active that sometimes you actually isolate an impurity that simply has a little bit of the actual substance present. But you don't. It's present in such a small amount, but it's active in such a large amount that you're actually, when you're isolating a compound, you think the compound then has this structure, but it turns out there's a small impurity in that structure, which is the real material.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, one of the scientists who were involved in this program, a man named Carol Williams at Harvard, fell into that trap. He had isolated and identified a compound. He said, "This is a juvenile hormone." Well, it turned out that had nothing to do with the juvenile hormone.
I think you
hormone.
Wrote that up in your, that's right. in your article, isn't it?
Right. It had nothing to do with the juvenile hormone. It, in fact, was the juvenile hormone, if there was anything present, was only an impurity in the sample that he actually isolated.
That was, you discovered that?
Yes.
That he, what he had found wasn't?
Wasn't juvenile hormone.
Yeah.
Right.
So how did the three of you work together, or did you?
Yes. They had done the isolation work. And then the subsequent chemistry, we had done the spectroscopic work here in the department. In fact, I did the NMR spectrum, which was the key tool that provided the structure.
Mm-hmm.
And from the NMR spectrum, we were able to deduce the structure. That, as I mentioned, was in fact a very pioneering effort, because it was the first time that anyone dared try to obtain a spectrum on a sample so small. And it was thought that it couldn't be done. We were very fortunate in that we did have state-of-the-art equipment here at the time. And we also had an electronics engineer present who really kept our instrumentation tuned so that it was in top-flight performance. So it really was performing at its optimum. If those two things weren't the case, we would have never been able to solve the problem. So we were critically dependent on the fact that we did have first-rate facilities in solving the problem. Once having done that and having a structure, then the next step was synthesis. And after having done the structure, in a matter of less than a month later, we had carried out our first synthesis.
Now, is this we or you?
Well, Carl Dahm and myself, the two of us, we each worked on the synthesis, and we had
independently or together.
Well, both. In that, we had several routes that we were pursuing simultaneously for different reasons. One, so Carl was taken through one route, I was taken through another route, and on a third route, I made some compounds, gave them to Carl, he carried out some reactions, and we went back and forth. So the two of us were actually physically doing these syntheses. So all the chemistry there was done, as far as our end of the spectrum was concerned, was done by myself, and Carl was the one who did the work in Roller's laboratories, as far as the chemistry was concerned.
Were you doing this with a sense of some of finding something very exciting, or was it more or less just a routine set of operations that you had to perform?
No, we had some very important goals in our synthesis, because there were some problems of structure which we could not really resolve from just the spectral data that we had. And so in trying to carry out the synthesis, we wanted to define some of these additional unknown points of structure, which were mainly related to spatial relationships.
Mm. And so this was something new for you. So you didn't know what was going to happen.
So we did not know some of the important structural characteristics of the juvenile hormone. We knew a gross structure, but we didn't know some of the important orientation of one group versus another. So we designed our syntheses. So the reason we were carrying through so many syntheses were, one, we wanted to carry through a synthesis fast to be able to confirm the gross structure, because we only had such a small amount. While we could identify the structure spectroscopically, that's no proof. The only way we could really prove it would be then to say, okay, if this is really right, then we can synthesize it. So we went through a very fast synthesis. It made a whole mess of isomers, but one of the isomers should have been this compound, and indeed it was. So that just proved the correctness of the gross structure. Then we had to prove the correctness of the geometrical shape of the molecule. And then that meant we had to be more controlled, but we made all of the possible isomers, geometrical isomers. And there are eight of them. We made all eight. And we knew, because of the way that we were synthesizing them, we knew the exact geometry of each of those eight. And then we could compare each one to the natural product. And finally, match up the correct synthetic one with the natural one. And that's how we finally...
So you knew you were going to be able to do it.
Oh, we knew we could do it. It was a matter of time to go through it to be able to do it. But we were trying to answer some important questions, so we were very excited. And the work went incredibly fast, because we were all very excited about the developments. Once we had the idea of what the structure was, it just provided the adrenaline for us all to really go through this fast. And as I said, it was just three weeks after we had the structure that we had finished our first synthesis. And that's incredibly short time. I mean, we were working almost 24 hours a day to get that done. And it was a very important, once we published this work, it set off an avalanche. Not only from a synthetic point of view, there's been a tremendous number of syntheses, there have been books written on syntheses, but it also set off the world in terms of the biology and the potential implications. There not only has these many of the traditional agricultural companies that have been involved in developing new pesticides, et cetera, initiate major research programs based on the discoveries that we made. There has been, in fact, the establishment of totally new companies that came about as a result of that. So it was a very exciting time, the juvenile hormone case. Unfortunately, Carl Dahm and Herbert Roller did not stay in Madison. Herbert moved to Texas A&M to set up an institute for invertebrate, invertebrate biology, I guess. or invertebrates zoology. And so he's he left Madison about 3 or 4 years after this.
Did they try to keep him? I mean, would it have been?
Well, I would have imagined that they would have tried to keep him. But the opportunity that was being offered to him at A&M was really an incredible opportunity I can't blame him for going off to do that. It was really a major challenge to have an institute essentially of his own for an important area, and was very exciting. Unfortunately, from what I understand, he didn't stay there either, and now I don't know where he's at.
This is tape 4 of the interview with Barry Trost. List of your accomplishments, this is, I guess, the first one that's listed.
Right.
For instance, your appointment to the National Academy. Do they also get credited with this, or is it yours? And if so, why?
Well, no. This really was a team effort.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the accomplishment here could not have been done without all of us participating in the way that we did.
Well, I mean, have they been appointed to the National Academy?
No. The accomplishments of a group of individuals. There's not going to be anybody to answer.
No. Okay.
Yeah, the accomplishment here has to really be one that is considered a shared accomplishment. It's not an accomplishment that was done solely by one person or another. I think in fairness, this is a program that was initiated by Roller.
Mm-hmm.
It was his program, and it was a major activity for himself, and he certainly is the one who conceptualized the problem and established a protocol for obtaining the material. Our accomplishments were the ones for taking it from the point of view of taking a chemical material, and being able to say, okay, you have the substance, now we can actually find out what it actually is.
Mm-hmm.
So our contributions weren't the conceptual ones of saying where the problem was. That was Roller's contribution. Ours was answering the question, providing the specific answers to what is this compound precisely, and finding ways that one could make it available so we could really know what it is.
But they couldn't have done this without you at all.
No, that's right. So it was like...
Because of what?
Well, it's like many aspects of science, that science is not separate empires where chemistry is distinct from biology, is distinct from physics, is distinct from what have you. It's really, nature is all of those things. And as we understand more about biology, zoology in this case, we begin realizing that more and more these are very complex chemical factories and chemical systems that are creating the entire animal that one ultimately sees. We are not, however, trained in that way, so that in terms of a zoologist trying to do this kind of problem doesn't have the kind of background that will allow, that at least at that time would allow him to really go into this at a chemical level.
Mm-hmm.
So that would not have been possible.
Yeah.
And certainly Herbert realized that.
Yeah.
So that's where the collaborations came in. Now, I think people are certainly much more aware. We talk a lot about interdisciplinary work because people are understanding what this is.
Was that the end of it then?
More or less. This turned out to be more or less a one-shot thing as far as the collaboration was concerned with Roller.
But I meant at the juvenile hormone and what you discovered. You didn't, there was nothing further to develop from that. Or did it lead into other work that you did? That's what I'm asking.
Oh, yes. Okay. the juvenile hormone did lead in our own program to, into some other areas of research. We did not specifically pursue juvenile hormone chemistry in our own laboratories, but it got us thinking about some problems that we probably would not have gotten involved in, which turned out subsequently to be very important in our group. The first of these was the question of where did juvenile hormone come from in the insect? That is, how did the insect synthesize juvenile hormone? Thinking about that problem led us into asking a question as to whether there would be a chemical way for taking I better back up a moment. Juvenile hormone that we have identified was a rather unusual structure. It was not what was considered to be a normal kind of natural product, in that it had more carbon atoms than it should have had. And so the question became, well, where do those additional carbons come from? Could the insect have a mechanism by which it could take the more normal types of substances that are present and add those carbons on, or did it synthesize this molecule de novo with those carbons already present from the very beginning? Ultimately, the answer to the question turned out to be the latter, that it actually synthesizes those compounds with those carbons already there. But we took the tack to saying, well, maybe they introduced those carbon atoms at a late stage. And so we wanted then to find a way that we might be able to do the same thing in a non-enzymatic fashion, that we could perhaps take some common materials that are found and introduce those carbon atoms.
You're saying we, and
my
we
group.
Wonder with.
Oh, that's me.
But what are you doing? You're sitting around with your graduate students and saying, here's this insect, and is it really a mutual? Are really a group of you discussing this insect, or is this something that you thought hard of?
Well, in this particular case, this was something that I did.
Uh-huh. All right, let's say I then.
I was wondering about whether this compound might have arisen by some transformations of these natural materials. And then the question that I asked was, well, could I find a way to do the same thing? And in fact, I tried to, on a number of occasions, convince some graduate students to take up a PhD thesis trying to develop some chemical models for what I felt might have been a biological pathway.
Mm-hmm.
But it was involving something, at least at that time, that was considered rather esoteric, and that was some chemistry of transition metals. This I felt would offer an opportunity to activate these normal molecules in a way that would allow us to add carbons just where we wanted to. But organic chemists weren't used to dealing with these transition metals. And so they really sort of shied away from
your graduate students.
Yes.
Because they didn't want to get out of the beaten path.
Well, they're just reluctant to get in something totally unknown where they thought they might simply get bogged down and not get any results for a long time, and therefore they would not really make progress towards getting a degree. So they were just sort of afraid to get involved in what they felt was a very speculative kind of project, and one that probably had little future. And they wanted to do something which they felt would have a better chance of success. As I said, when I was picking a program, one of my criteria was that it was something that I felt I could be successful at.
Mm-hmm.
And the graduate students here are no different in that regard. They would like to pick a project that they also felt they would have a chance of being successful at. One of my graduate students did get involved in a what we thought would be a more controlled synthesis. That is, I had two projects related to juvenile hormone that I was trying to convince graduate students to get involved in. One of them dealt with what I would call a more traditional approach for synthesis, and the other would be this this method that I was talking about. And I was able to convince a graduate student to do the first project, the one dealing with the more traditional one, but I was never able to convince a graduate student to do the latter one. But I was determined that we would get involved in this kind of chemistry. It was at a time, however, where I did not have enough time in the laboratory to do it myself, so I really had to find a student to do it. I was getting, say, far enough along in my career that I was able to start getting postdoctoral students. And so one of the very first postdoctoral students that joined my group, I had begin working on this project.
And he didn't mind so much not being having a project that would get him his PhD since he already had it.
Right. So I didn't give him so much of a choice, I should say. Oh. I said, yeah, this is something I really wanted to do. I didn't force him to do this project, but I did impress upon him that it is something that I really did want to do. And he struggled, and he was from New Zealand, actually, and he didn't. No, he seemed like it might be fun to do that, and he struggled with this for a long time. I'd say for the first nine, he was here for a year, and for the first 9 months, he really was struggling with trying to get anything out of this approach. But at the end of 9 months, we started to make some breakthroughs. And the last 3 months that he was here with us really were incredibly productive. And that work eventually did lead to the kind of development that we had set out for ourselves. And that is to find a way to specifically be able to add carbon atoms in the way that I mentioned. And in fact began what has become a major activity for our research group ever since. And that is developing synthetic methods based on transition metal chemistry. But that area of research really had its origins in my thinking about the problems associated with juvenile hormone chemistry.
And is there anything to say about the breakthroughs? You say after 9 months of fruitless work, suddenly you began to have some breakthroughs. Was that luck or?
No, that was not luck. That was really just sheer hard work and trying to really understand why we were not getting success. The breakthroughs came about because we have carried out so many different experiments, and by analyzing the results of all those experiments and knowing what was being recorded in the literature, we finally were able to pin down what might be the important factors in trying to get the kind of chemistry that we wanted to happen. And by being able to pin down the factors that we could then suggest reagents in order to accomplish the goal that we had set out. And that's indeed what he did. So it took 9 months of experiments in just getting enough information.
So they weren't wasted?
No, they were not. We could not have, it's not something that we could have just gone into, say, at that advanced point.
Yeah.
It really was an evolutionary process that it provided some of the underlying information that we had to have.
So for him, it was rewarding in the end.
Yes, I believe he feels that way today. I mean, that's now been quite some time ago, but it was very rewarding. He really was a pioneer in our group, and I think he recognizes that. And of course, he got a lot of publications out of the work that he did during the time that he was there. And it really provided a major enterprise for us ever since. It was consideration of that problem that opened up what I call our research in what I like to refer to as trying to develop the chemists' enzymes, that is, catalysts that can be designed to carry out organic reactions with very selective types of molecular changes.
Was this a new kind of thing to do?
Yes. If you consider that prior to the 1960s, there was almost no, well, I think one could go further than that, there were no what we call homogeneous catalysts that were being practiced from the point of view of organic synthesis. It was quite revolutionary to think that you might be able not only to have reactions that would be synthetically useful with homogeneous catalysts, but that you might be able really to even design reactions and design catalysts. Now, we weren't the only ones who started to get involved in the field at the time. So, in part, the impetus for us to get into that tract came from the readings that I do in terms of my keeping up in the literature and seeing some of the developments that were happening, especially in the area of inorganic chemistry related to organic type molecules, what we call organometallic chemistry, and seeing some of the things that were going on in that area led me to suggest that this might be the kind of approach that we might take in order to accomplish this mimic of the JH biosynthesis. So it didn't come out of, you know, out of the blue. It really came out of my reading and seeing what is the problems that we have in trying to accomplish this kind of synthetic objective. And from the reading, seeing the kind of properties that these transition metals have, and saying, well, it looks like they may have some of the kind of chemical properties that would be almost uniquely suited for solving this problem. And that's where I was able to make the match.
So you had a reasonable expectation that you could succeed in doing this?
Yes. As I said, it didn't just come out of the blue. It really came out of having a fairly extensive familiarization with the current literature and saying, this looks like some developments that are over in this area of chemistry that look very exciting, very interesting, but these have never been considered in the context of the kinds of problems that organic chemists are really involved in. And saying, hey, they should have some applications here, and maybe we can develop them here. And that's what we started to do. And this certainly, our work, probably the work of E.J. Corey at Harvard, were the ones that were most significant in terms of really setting the stage for organic chemists, that this is a practical way of designing new reactions for organic synthesis. And now, today, there are hundreds of practitioners of this area of science, this area being still a pretty broad one, use of transition metals for catalysis and designing transition metals for carrying out selective organic reactions.
And you're still doing it, or did you get bored with it?
No, we are still doing it. We've been involved now for probably about 12, 13 years. We started in about 1972, 73, and it's still going to be a major avenue of our activity for a long time to come. So I see this as something that we will continue. So to me represents probably one of the most important challenges that one has in chemical synthesis, and I don't see it being a type of activity that is going to be, lose its luster for a very long time, because we are just at such an early stage in its development. Even though I say that there are now several hundred practitioners in this area, it is such a small part of what could be a tremendously immense field that I don't think there's going to be a likelihood that there's going to be a loss of opportunity for an awful long time. That we still have an awful long way to go.
I got out of the library a couple of days ago a book by Isaac Asimov, a collection of essays on chemistry, hoping I might develop a bit of vocabulary. And I, just before I came over here, I happened to reach a chapter on catalysts and on the history of them, which I didn't get a chance to finish. But do you ever think historically about, think about how catalysts were used and how they began? And has that started to interest you yet, or do you wait until you're 60 or 70?
Well, I don't think I spend very much time thinking about it. Certainly, catalysts have been around in chemistry almost since chemistry has been around. But right now, I guess we're too wrapped up in doing things rather than trying to really think back as to where did all these things get started. Obviously, things like that cross one's mind at various occasions, but it's not something that I would say it's a serious undertaking.
No, it was just fun for me to see that I would be able to learn a little bit about catalysts before I came and talked to you. Well, we better stop, I guess.
Yeah, stop it today.